Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to a special edition of Chinook. It's a reading from Shadow of the Hunter by Dick Nelson, a collection of stories based on Eskimo life in the village of Ulleronik. On the map, that's Wainwright. But Nelson uses the Inupiaq name throughout the book. It helps differentiate that village as Nelson described it in 1964 from the village of today. And while the stories are accurate to the finest detail, the characters are combinations of real and made-up people. Some events did happen, and some could have. Some are distillations of many occurrences. Thus, one telling of one man's seal hunt represents hundreds of similar hunts, not only in the life of Master Hunter Sikeuk, but for past and perhaps future generations of hunters.
Sikeuk climbed to the top of a nearby ridge and scanned the pack with his binoculars. Jagged lines of hummocks pierced sharply into the brightening sky. The day was now full and blue, brilliant refracted twilight glowing high above the seaward horizon. He smiled as he squinted into the brightness. Indeed, it was Sikanyasuk Tutkik, moon of the returning sun. But the cold needling his cheekbones reminded him that it was still midwinter, and that he must work fast to hunt before darkness closed over the sky again. He saw no hint of life in the pack, but the configurations of ice told him where best to look for it. Just beyond the ridge where he stood was a small plain of flat ice. He was surprised to see that it was cut by a broad crack, perhaps 10 yards across, covered with newly frozen ice. The crack, which must have opened during the past week's storm, made a jagged swath across the flat and sliced cleanly through a ridge on its far side. Sikeuk marveled at the power of moving ice, which could split a heavy ridge into two sections as a man would cut through blubber with his knife. The crack probably ran for miles, and there would almost certainly be a few breathing holes in its covering of young ice. It also offered Sikeuk an easy trail through the hummocky areas. Sikeuk made his way down the ridge and onto the frozen crack. He followed it across the flat, through the chasm of the split ridge, and onto another flat. There he saw what he was looking for. Almost in the middle of the crack was a nearly perfect little dome, the allu of a ringed seal. He peered closely into its opening and saw deep black inside. "It's good," he murmured softly to himself. The blackness was a circle of open water with a transparent skin of new ice forming at its edges, just a few inches below the quarter-sized opening of the allu. Not an hour before, while Sikeuk walked out across the landfast ice, a seal had risen here to breathe. There was no time to waste. For all he knew, the animal might be heading for this hole now, and he was not ready for it. He slipped off his hunting bag and rifle, laying them on the ice together with his unak, a long, iron-pointed staff that he used mainly for testing the ice. Then he went quickly to the nearest hummock and kicked free 2 blocks of ice for a stool and footrest. After carrying them back, he again inspected the interior of the allu. Its opening was slightly off-center, and the tunnel appeared to angle somewhat away from the vertical. From this, Sikeuk knew which direction the seal would face when it came to breathe, and he would angle his rifle slightly for the deadliest possible shot. Now he placed the 2 ice blocks about 1 foot from the hole along its southeast side. He calculated automatically, almost without thought, the effects of wind and light. There was enough brightness to create a faint shadow, which must not fall across the hole, and he must not sit upwind lest the seal be frightened by his scent. He also preferred to face away from the biting chill of the breeze. He emptied his hunting bag onto the thick ice alongside the crack and pulled his rifle from its canvas sheath. The bag would insulate and cushion his stool, while the sheath insulated the footrest. Eskimos always took pains to minimize loss of heat from their bodies in every way possible, and Sikeuk knew the weight would be a cold one even in the best circumstances. He placed his unak on the thick ice, where its shadow would not be visible from below, and he adjusted the ice blocks so they would not jiggle or squeak noisily. Then he sat down on 1 block and put his feet on the other so that his legs were held straight out before him, Eskimo fashion. He could sit this way for many hours without tiring. When he was seated atop the ice blocks, his menacing presence could not be detected by the seal looking up through the glowing translucence of gray ice. The bolt of his rifle clicked loudly in the brittle cold as he thrust a shell into the chamber. Then he placed the weapon crosswise over the top of his boots, where it was least likely to compress his clothing and cause chilling. Its muzzle faced the Alu, but did not hang over where the seal might see it. He had taken the precaution of standing a flat chip of ice alongside the little opening to screen his intrusive shape from the seal's eyes as it rose to breathe. Now he would wait. It was impossible to know when the seal would appear. In 50 winters of hunting at breathing holes, Sakerk had learned not to think too much of time. It might be 15 minutes, perhaps an hour, perhaps many hours. Sometimes the animal never returned. Sakerk knew of old men who in times of starvation had waited beside an Alu for 24 hours. Nowadays, the young men refused to hunt at breathing holes, preferring to wait until a wide crack or lead formed so they could shoot seals in the open water. When Sakerk was a boy, the men had relied upon harpoons, which could not be thrown far enough to strike a seal swimming freely out in a lead. But a harpoon was as good as a rifle for hunting at breathing holes, perhaps better. When a seal was harpooned, a line attached to the point ensured that the animal would not sink or be carried away by the current. Young men said that breathing hole hunting was too cold, that it involved too much waiting. The old men said only that people must eat. They had learned the art of enduring patience, as if they could merge their thoughts with the timeless physical world that surrounded them. Life, after all, was a game of waiting. One could not expect that the weather, ice, and animals would do a man's bidding. If a man would live, he must persist, wait, endure. Sakerk was enveloped in still silence, interrupted only by the occasional buffeting of wind against his parka hood. His breath condensed on the ruff around his face and on his scraggly mustache, coating each hair with thick white frost. He could feel the immensity of the pack surrounding him, its quiet, latent power. Radiant amber flowed up the wall of the sky before him, hinting of warmth in some distant world, while the pervasive cold drew closer around his body. Time faded away to a dim consciousness at the core of the hunter's mind. Twilight grew and spread slowly southward, then edged toward the west. The fullest light of midday came, then imperceptibly began to fade. Sakerk drew his arms from the sleeves of his parka and held them against his body for warmth. He was shivering. Frost had collected on his eyebrows and lashes. Occasionally, he poked a bare hand up through the neck of his parka and held it against his cheek to warm the stiff, numb flesh. His toes felt large and icy cold. Perhaps the temperature was falling, he thought. Indeed, it was now -40, and the wind was fading as it grew colder. Almost 2 hours had passed. A growing ache spread up Sakerk's legs and back, but he dared not move to relieve the discomfort. The seal might be near enough to hear any noise transmitted through the ice to the water below, so he moved only his head and arms, even then very carefully. It was also important to watch the surrounding ice in case a polar bear happened to approach him. Bears would occasionally stalk a man if they were so thin and hungry that starvation drove fear out of them. But today it seemed there was no life anywhere except for the silent lives beneath the pack. Sakerk wondered how deep the water under him might be, and he thought the current would soon shift and flow from the east, as it always did when intensely cold air moved in off the great expanse of land that stretched eastward away from the coast. He was now shivering hard, and he wondered if his shaking might jiggle the ice stool, making a noise that would scare away the seals. He smiled, thinking what a great joke that would be after such a long, cold wait. But beneath him at that moment, a seal torpedoed through the black-gray water, darting and arcing in pursuit of the fleeting silver of fishes. It dodged between the blue and emerald-green walls of ice protruding downward beneath the hummocks. Huge inverted ice mountains blocked its path, but it sensed them and turned away before striking invisible barriers deep in the blackness. In the freedom of its dense medium, the seal could ignore the encumbrances of gravity. It swam on its side, then upside down, then coasted to a stop in midwater. There it hung quietly in the dark silence, drifting slowly with the current, like a footloose star in the vastness of space. But this space was far from an empty void. Nervous shoals of fish left glowing trails as they spun and needled through luminescent plankton. Tiny jellyfish pulsed and parachuted, trailing delicate streamers beneath them. And far below, crabs littered the bottom, waiting for those above to die and become their food. For more than a minute, the seal remained motionless, ignoring the fish that swam too near. It was in need of air and was listening. Then it suddenly whirled and shot upward toward a circle of white that glimmered faintly in the high distance. When it reached the underside of the ice, the seal turned slowly beneath the circle. It hesitated a moment, then swam slowly upward into the narrow passage. Reaching the surface, it poked its nose out for an instant, sampling the air, then dropped again. The air was fresh and stinging of cold. It rose again, emerging into the bright igloo of ice, globed eyes wide and black, nostrils flaring and closing. In the silence of the pack, after a long wait, the seal's approach was startling and exciting. Sakayak first heard, almost sensed without hearing, a pulsation of the water inside the alu. Then he saw water flow through the opening and over the ice outside, where it instantly froze to a fresh glaze. This water was forced up ahead of the seal as it rose from below. Sakayak heard scratching as the seal cleared away newly formed ice at the tunnel's upper opening. He quickly slipped his arms into the sleeves of his parka, then remained perfectly still. The cold had vanished. Shivering ceased as warmth spread from mind to muscle. He fixed his eyes on the alu, consumed with intense concentration. His lips moved slightly, almost imperceptibly. "Come, seal," he whispered, asking the animal to give itself to him. "Come." It was only a thought this time. In a moment, the seal obeyed Sakayak's will. It took a first short, hissing breath, smelling the air for signs of danger. He did not move. He expected the brief silence that followed, knowing the next breath would be a deep one. Whoosh! It was a long, drawn-out hiss that sent a misty spray from the opening. This noise was loud enough to drown out the sound of Sakayak's movement as he reached down and picked up his rifle from his legs. He was careful to spread his arms so his clothing would not scrape noisily, and he was still before the deep breath was finished. Whoosh! Again the animal breathed. Sakayak lifted his rifle and held it vertical with the thumb of his upper hand against the trigger. Again he waited as the second breath stopped. Whoosh! On the third breath, he moved his rifle straight above the alu, its muzzle inches from the opening. His face was expressionless. His resolve was complete. Without a second's hesitation, he deliberately squeezed the trigger. For the seal, breath cut short, a sudden crack only half heard before the world was shut out in closing clouds of black. For the hunter, a sudden deafening explosion. The alu split and shattered. Fragments of ice dyed crimson. The seal bobbing on the pulse of water, grotesque and broken, instantly detached from the reality of life. Sakayak ran to fetch his unak. Using its sharp point, he chipped the rest of the alu away, then snagged the animal with the metal hook on its other end. The seal was still quivering, so he held it until movement stopped. With the knife he carried on his belt, he slit the skin of its upper lip. Then he pushed the loop end of his seal-pulling harness through this cut and fastened it around the animal's nose. This done, Sakayak held the line under one foot while he chiseled the hole until it was large enough so he could pull out the seal. If he had not secured the seal quickly with a line, it might have been carried off by the current. In thicker ice, where the seal would enter through a long cigar-shaped tunnel, this would be unnecessary. Winter-killed seals were buoyant from their thick layer of blubber, so they would float well up into the tunnel where the current could not take them away. Finally, Sakayak pulled the seal out onto the ice. It was completely limp and flexible, like a sack full of liquid. Blood flowed and coagulated on its skin, freezing in thick layers around the wound. The warmth of excitement that had flared inside Sakayak died quickly, and he found himself shivering again. He rested for a few minutes, looking at the distant sky. The light was fading, and he had a long walk before him.
Richard Nelson reading from his book, The Shadow of the Hunter, published by the University of Chicago Press. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, once again talking with Dick Nelson, an anthropologist who has returned some of the knowledge he has gained from living in the village of Wainwright to the Inupiaq people, in the form of a book of stories called Shadow of the Hunter. Nelson's year in the village was spent learning about hunting and survival. He learned, like young Inupiaq hunters have learned for generations, from being teased about their mistakes.
One of those things that I felt the strongest about was the teasing. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, being totally unfamiliar with the Eskimo environment and lifeway, I made a tremendous number of mistakes.
Like standing on the harpoon line as
yes,
you throw the harpoon
right.
out.
And that is one of the autobiographical episodes in which I stood on the harpoon line and threw the harpoon at a walrus that if I had struck it, it would have been a great tragedy. I might have gone down below with it. And I was teased and teased and teased for these things. When I first went to live in Wainwright and went out on my first long hunt, a caribou hunt, inland for several days with a group of hunters from the village, they teased me so much that I thought, gee, I don't think I'm going to like it here. And, of course, I made so many mistakes. Practically everything I did was a mistake, and people were just holding their sides with laughter. But I had a very important experience. On another of my early hunts, there was another young man, this man, an Eskimo, along, and I saw that they teased him much worse than they teased me. And I realized, oh, it isn't because I'm a stupid white man that I'm getting all this teasing. It's because I'm a learner, and this is how Eskimo people learn, because believe you, me, after I made these mistakes, I never made them again. Never. And what these people were doing was looking out for my survival. They were doing me a big favor. But I will admit to you that I never got completely accustomed to it. You know, it always was a little hard for me to take because I wasn't raised with this culturally, you know. But I'll tell you that it increased my learning and the other young man's learning enormously that we were teased this way.
To Nelson, knowledge is the key to Eskimo survival, their most important tool beyond the tangible. The ingenious implements and engineering skills that the Eskimo people are known for. For the thousands of years they've lived in the Arctic, they have observed to the smallest detail everything around them.
One of the very forceful impressions I had in living with Eskimo people, and of course I was there to try to record their knowledge, and so it was my interest as well, was the fact that these people have a really deep commitment to the acquisition of knowledge, to learning. In fact, the very first experience I had hunting out on the sea ice off the coast from Wainwright was one in which a man, you know, snagged a seal that he had shot, and after he got up, he looked at me and he had this big smile. He said, "You see, Eskimo is a scientist." And I didn't understand at that point what he meant, but I recognize as time went by that indeed the Eskimo people are really dedicated scientists, and that they devote so much of their time to observing the world around them and learning about it and then talking about it, communicating constantly. That's why I was saying earlier that Eskimo people talk constantly about these subjects of animals and sea ice and weather and these kinds of things. And it's not only a matter of that it's their consuming interest, but it's also a mechanism for getting this knowledge spread around. One of the things I've always believed about expert elder Eskimo hunters is that they have as much knowledge inside their heads as, say, a highly trained scientist or engineer or technician in our society does. This is a very hard thing to quantify, and again, it's, see, you're getting out there into the intangibles and the abstractions. But I've always felt that if you could record the knowledge, even of a single animal that's inside the expert Eskimo hunter's mind, you would have probably a stack of thick volumes if you took all his knowledge and experience and tried to write it all out. And of course, the value and importance of this is obvious, because knowledge is what keeps you alive in the Arctic. Now, as far as today, back in the mid-1960s when I lived in Wainwright, I thought, this stuff's going to disappear fast. It's going to be gone in 10 years. It's now 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that continually amazes me when I go back there is that people are still doing this stuff, still out there hunting, dedicated, sometimes passionately dedicated to continuing this way of life, in spite of the fact that things are changing. There's an increasing involvement with wage economy. There's a constant growth in all sorts of involvement with the outside world. The environment is being changed by the, you might say, the intrusion of Western technology, oil development, and all the rest of it. And yet the people are still out there in the spring with their skin boats hunting whales, still out there going across the tundra looking for caribou. And in order to do this stuff, the knowledge has to be transmitted. Young people who I thought 15 years ago were going to go into another line of work are out there getting food to feed their families. You know, they were kids then. Now they're bringing home caribou to feed their kids.
Are they doing it with the same knowledge, grace, patience as your older hunter? You have an old expert hunter that begins the book and follows through, and his name is pronounced...
Sakia.
Is he still there? Is there somebody left that has the patience to sit for days, it seems, at a seal breathing hole? In the book, you say that your character sort of mourns the fact that the young men are not willing to do that anymore. How about that?
These kinds of changes are definitely taking place. It requires, for example, less knowledge to hunt a seal with a rifle than to hunt a seal with a harpoon. Less knowledge to hunt caribou with a snow machine than to hunt caribou with a dog team. I think we have seen over the last 100 years or so both a process of attrition and of change in this traditional body of knowledge. The Eskimo 100 years ago knew nothing about a snow machine, but knew a lot about using a harpoon. The modern Eskimo young man doesn't know anything about using a harpoon, or very little. They do use them for certain kinds of hunting. And so there's been both a loss of certain kinds of traditional knowledge, a growth of other kinds of knowledge as new techniques have been developed. But overall, I do feel that the younger Eskimo hunters of today have a less intricate and sophisticated knowledge of the environment than their elders. Because what technology does, higher levels of technology does, is it replaces knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that a fisherman on the coast of Alaska or Washington or California, using a big fancy boat, 100 feet long, knows much less about the sea than the old fisherman did using a rowboat, rowing dory. The same kind of process, I think, is happening, as well as the change in dedication, as you say, patience, the younger people are less so. Perseverance, the younger people are less so. A kind of society that our grandparents would probably, kind of change that our grandparents would probably tell us has happened to us as well.
Sure. You go to any small town in the Midwest and hear all the things that the younger generation doesn't know anymore and doesn't have respect for anymore.
Right.
And everything else. What about, tell me your old hunter's name again.
Sakeak.
He knows the secrets of animals. He can talk to them. He seems to know in his sleep when a whale is coming. Does he?
Yes. The particular man was a remarkably gifted hunter, the greatest of all the hunters that I had heard of among these people. And I don't doubt for a minute from what I saw him do that he had senses beyond what we consider to be normal or usual. And this man, Sakeak, who is partially based on a real character and partially based on several different old people who I knew, had done incredible stories, and some of the stories, of course, are are told in here about him.
Do you think the animals listen to people, can understand people talking?
I don't know. I have learned from my teachers in the village of Wainwright, as well as from my teachers in other Alaskan Native villages, that animals have the power to understand what people say, that animals could understand what I said right now at this distance. In the same way that I suppose people from my own culture learn that whatever they say, God will hear them. And it's a very good parallel, I think, that there is something spiritual in the animal world that can know when it's disrespected. So some of my elder teachers in Wainwright would say that if you talk badly about the walrus, it will hear you and it'll get you. Or the polar bear, similarly, and other animals as well. I am not dedicated either way to a point of view on this. I've always respected those rules, and I still do. I've always watched what I said about animals in the way that I think my teachers would expect me to. And what lies behind it, I don't know. I suppose any more than we know in our own culture what lies behind our ideology and belief.
I'm just wondering if, in order for you to hunt successfully, whether you have to do it, whether you, Dick Nelson, has to do it like an Eskimo, or whether it works another way, whether you have to return the backbone into the sea or whatever it is,
well,
and say thank you. Whether
I don't know. I suppose myself, as a person who, for all my life, I've probably been more dedicated to love of animals than anything else I can think of. In fact, the reason I went into anthropology was because I felt I could learn more about nature through native people than through biologists. I feel that whatever lies behind this ideology, whatever reality it has in a mystical or supernatural world, is perhaps less relevant to me than the fact that the gestures are profound, than the fact that if by showing this kind of respect for the things that give you life, you are doing something that I think is important, regardless of whether there's going to be any punishment for you not doing it. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. I'm saying that to me, a code of etiquette toward nature is as important as a code of etiquette toward other human beings. And certainly people like the Inupiaq Eskimos practice this. And I guess part of my following the system is my belief that we should too. That all of us who depend for our lives on the environment should treat it with utmost respect.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's our greatest failing as a culture that we don't.
Dick Nelson, author of Shadow of the Hunter. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.